Hello and welcome to this first part of a special three-part podcast series from Blackwell Online about one of the most successful medical books ever published, the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. A book so beloved by generations of medical students and junior doctors that it's more commonly known as the Cheese and Onion for its distinctively coloured cover. And it even has its own Facebook page that has attracted 80,000 likes. The book is so much part of the landscape of medical education that it may come as a surprise to learn that it has not always existed. And an even greater surprise that there was outright hostility to it when it first appeared in the mid-1980s, from some who felt that it would make medicine too easy. One senior medic removed it from the pocket of a junior doctor and threw it out of the window, saying, "That's medicine for auxiliary nurses." Nearly three decades on, it holds a cherished place in the hearts of most medics in the UK, and also exists in the US and over a dozen translated editions. It's given rise to dozens of progeny in a host of specialist areas, effectively founding a dynasty of medical handbooks. These three podcasts provide an opportunity to meet the people behind the OHCM, whose names you may only have glanced at as you pick up your well-thumbed copy of the book. We hear in Programme 1 how the book came into existence and how it set out to challenge the prevailing culture of medical education. In Programme 2, we explore the philosophy behind the book and what part the authors hope it plays in helping students become good doctors. And in the final programme, we look at how the handbook is kept up to date and how it's preparing to meet the challenges of the future, both in the world of medicine and electronic publishing. But first, let me introduce my guests. In this first programme, the two authors who first had the idea for the handbook in the early 1980s, Murray Longmore and Tony Hope. Murray is a GP in rural Sussex and remains an author of the handbook eight editions on. He's also a co-author of the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Specialties. Tony has recently retired as Professor of Medical Ethics at the University of Oxford, where he had originally studied medicine before going on to specialise in psychiatry. It was also at Oxford that Tony and Murray met, became friends, and conceived the idea for the handbook. When we met recently at Oxford University Press to record these programmes, Tony brought along a copy of the original letter they had sent to the publisher proposing the book over 30 years ago. I asked him to tell me about it.
This is a letter written on the 1st of January 1982, and got the response from the editor that this is a strange way to spend one New Year's Day. And the letter is simply a page and a half of typescript. It's in the days even before word processing. The kind of letter that wouldn't be possible, really, as a proposal for a book these days.
It would be wrong to say it was back of the envelope, but it is sketchy by contemporary standards, one could say.
Indeed. But also, rereading it after 20 years of not seeing it, there's a certain freshness that today's bureaucratic world rather lacks, I think.
It's got a certain youthful confidence, hasn't it?
It has, yes, a confidence I think I've lost since I was that age.
Well, it's a great strength not to know too much of the future or too much medicine when you're starting a project like this, and we were in that happy state then. We knew what we wanted to know. We didn't know exactly what it was, but we knew we wanted to get it down on paper.
So tell me then, what went before this youthful, confident letter proposing this book to OUP? How had you come up with this idea? Do you remember where it started?
Well, I think it starts with the friendship between Murray and I. Murray and I were clinical students together in the University of Oxford, and we'd both done philosophy in our first degree. And I remember the first day of meeting Murray, and he's always been an eccentric person, and I immediately warmed to his eccentricities. So we worked very much together as students, and Murray carried a little book, like a blank diary.
When I was doing philosophy, I was coming up to finals and wrote a summary of each philosopher's contribution and their various ideas on the left-hand page, and left the right-hand page blank for my own ideas and critical insights. It came about that I had no critical insights or good ideas. And so when I started clinical medicine, I had this nice notebook on which the right-hand pages were all blank. So being a cheapskate, I thought, well, I will use this notebook for clinical medicine. And so I started writing down what we were taught on ward rounds and the 5 or is it 11 causes of atrial fibrillation or whatever, opposite Hume's general epistemology. And there was some sort of intercourse between the left and the right-hand pages, and that continued all through the book, and Tony was very much part of the philosophical input into the book and the ethical input as well.
So I saw Murray had this book he would keep bringing out of his pocket to write notes, because when you're a medical student, you receive information from all sorts of different places. You might be on a ward around, you might be in the clinic, you might be at a lecture, you might be in the library reading something. And the difficulty is integrating all that. So I thought Murray's idea, I hadn't read the pages on Hume on the other side, all I saw were the medical parts. So I created my own pocket book. This was in the days before Filofax was at least known. I think it may have existed. So I cut down an ordinary A4 ring file so it fitted in my pocket and created pages from a very thin paper that I could put in it. And I started writing my own book. And so by the end of our 3 years as clinical students, Murray and I had really a sort of mini textbook of medicine in our pockets from our having worked together.
And what we found when we were coming up to finals was that people kept on asking us, not about Hume's general epistemology, but about those causes of atrial fibrillation. And we would just be able to turn up the page and tell them what they were. And they found that very useful and said that we should publish it. And I said that was a silly idea and I didn't do that sort of thing at all. But Tony thought it might be a good idea. And so we began to think that it could fulfill a wider need than just our own personal need.
In effect, when we became junior doctors, we worked together for 6 months and then we worked separately for 6 months. And I carried my book, and as a junior doctor, I found it very helpful. I mean, we should perhaps say something about the books that were available at that time, which were very unfriendly towards junior doctors. I don't know whether it was when we were students or when we were junior doctors, but I think one of the ideas that started to come is that we wanted a book that would actually support us in this difficult job rather than feel like a cane for beating our backs with.
Another thing that we found in the books that existed, they would say, a book might say, treat the patient's headache or constipation or something, without any indication as to exactly what drug to use or at what dose. And we knew we were shortly going to be on the sharp end, and we had to give exact doses. The BNF didn't exist, the British National Formulary, in a comprehensive form at all. And this prescribing data was just not easily available. When we went on elective, I went on elective to the Solomon Islands just before finals and wanted to take a book to revise from for finals. And there was no very good comprehensive book. We had to take a whole lot of journals with us, and that was very inconvenient. And we thought then, wouldn't it be nice to have something portable?
It was actually worse than Murray was indicating. I mean, all the books, there were practical books which were for emergencies only. Those existed and were very good. But actually 90% of being a junior doctor is not dealing with emergencies. It's things like ensuring that a patient with jaundice is safe for surgery or how to read an ECG, that kind of thing. The books out there, apart from emergency books, were totally unpractical. They would spend pages on the exact sex ratio, you know, three times as many men as women have this disease or whatever. Huge amount on that, nothing on the practicalities. And they were also written by consultants who didn't know what it was like to be a junior doctor or a student. So, for example, I remember one book very irritatingly said these two things. It said, you must treat a patient with pneumonia on the basis of the sensitivities of the organism. That is, you must have the antibiotic that fits the organism. You have to grow the organism and test the antibiotics. That takes some time to find out. It also said, you must treat the patient with pneumonia straight away. Now, this is the kind of luxury that a consultant coming on a ward round a day later, he'll have the sensitivities and he can choose the antibiotic. But when it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you can't follow those instructions. So they were very unpractical, most of the textbooks in our time.
We wanted very much to support doctors and students in this way, but equally we wanted to make them feel pleased that they'd chosen medicine. It can be quite discouraging, early life on the wards, and to know that someone had been through it and had flourished and enjoyed it, I thought, and we both thought, would be valuable for our readers. And we wanted to communicate that from the beginning, that we'd been there and we'd enjoyed it and we'd managed it, and it could be quite good fun as well.
I mean, in some ways, I think the general attitude was very macho to medicine then. You had to pretend that you enjoyed everything. I mean, Murray just now said that medicine was enjoyable. Well, that's true, but also, you know, being a junior doctor working 120 hours a week for a sane person was not entirely enjoyable. And it was very stressful. But you weren't allowed to say that. There was a distinct taboo as a medical student in our time to even suggest that you wouldn't love to work 120 hours a week or to be by yourself at 3 a.m. with a desperately sick patient struggling to make them better. And so part, I think, of what we wanted to do with the book was for it to be a friend, as Murray says, a friend that had been there, but also one that recognised that this was extremely stressful and you didn't have to be macho. You just had to be kind and considerate both to yourself and to your patients.
Well, that was a very strong sense that I got from it, coming to it for the first time, that it was written by human beings and it was addressed to human beings. And it recognised the fact that those human beings were treating other human beings. And it wasn't simply a digest of facts and figures.
And that bit about human beings treating other human beings, there was a sort of idea that if consultants were harsh on their junior staff, that would be good for patients. The sort of idea that you push your junior staff to really work hard for patients. And I think perhaps we both did some psychology as well as philosophy before we went into medicine. And I think one of our thoughts, and in a sense our experiences too, was actually if a consultant cares for a junior doctor, the junior doctor's more likely to care for the patients, and that a caring attitude towards staff is actually part of a caring attitude for an organisation in general.
So tell me a bit more about how you went from having these notebooks, your own private notebooks that you'd been compiling, and you'd got the contract from OUP. How did you then go about turning it into the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine? Was that a rather daunting prospect once you'd actually been accepted and got the contract?
Yes, it was. And I think we realised that we couldn't simply publish our notes. Those two books we had in our pocket formed a kind of syllabus almost, and an outline, but they were a long, long way from information that could be published. I remember we got the contract and we said we would deliver it in a year, and we delivered it 13 months later. So we wrote the book in 13 months, though it then went through a very long period of review from OUP and was finally published 3 years after that. So it was a very long process.
We decided quite early on that we wanted the artificial constraint of having one page per topic. We knew the book could grow infinitely, and having one page a topic was our way of handcuffing us to something practical and pocket-sized. And that meant that the writing of it was very highly structured. And we wrote in the days before computers were available. So we had squared paper, and it would be two letters per square and 67 spaces long. And we were rigidly constrained to that. We thought at first it would be a two-column format like the Pocket Oxford Dictionary. And my partner later became my wife, typed it all up in two columns. And halfway through, we realized we didn't have to have two columns and that it could be produced as a single column version, and she retyped it all. In that process, there were some things that she refused to type, and the book was greatly enriched by that third mind working on the book from its early stages.
Now, Murray talks about the handcuffs that we put ourselves in for getting the pages right. Murray has always been much more rigorous and imaginative than me, and I was just for sort of having a total number of words for page. It was Murray who sent me this squared paper that I had to fill in every letter, and then when we started to type, I had to set the typewriter so that it would ring at 64 letters and not allow me to go beyond 67. So it was a very rigid format in order to keep the blank pages blank. The first edition had no spreading onto the blank pages at all, and I remember one example that one of the readers that OUP sent to said was just impossible. We were trying to get tuberculosis on one page. It started off at 4 pages, and we became very good at editing down. The red pencil was an important instrument for writing the book. And we finally got it down, but the only way we could do it was by calling the tuberculous bacillus a germ, because it only has four letters. So the whole of the TB page referred to the germ, and this went out to the readers, and the readers just said, you cannot call the tuberculous bacillus a germ in a serious medical textbook. So we then had to lose some other letters elsewhere. But that was the kind of rigour that we forced on ourselves.
And why we forced this rigour on ourselves and did not allow ourselves initially to spill over onto the blank pages was that we wanted the book to be fully participatory with the reader, so that the reader could add their own notes and ideas and insights, to give the impression that we weren't writing down to our readers, we were expecting them to contribute to the enterprise of learning medicine. And that's has continued, although we have spoiled our rule and written on the right-hand side of pages, and we give our unreserved apologies for that.
Murray and I didn't always agree on what we should cut out when we were trying to edit down. When we were writing it, it was in that period when the whole issue about gender language was becoming an issue, so he's and she's and such like, and I was keen that we should sometimes use she and sometimes use he, and Murray cut out all the she's, turned them all into he's, and then solved the gender problem when I said, but we can't just do that. And he said, no, it's very simple. We just write at the beginning the following statement. Throughout this book, we have used he to mean he or she because he has one less letter than she.
So those rigors go all the way through. The quotations, the insights from the world beyond medicine, were they already present right at the start?
To be honest, I can't remember. I mean, Murray and I were very close friends, quite independently of writing the book. We'd both done philosophy. We were both very keen on literature. So a lot of our discussions and conversations involved talking about things outside medicine, or indeed talking about medicine as it appeared in literature and that kind of thing. So I guess we already had a strong interest in issues outside medicine.
We also found that this fed into the brevity of the book, because sometimes a good author can describe things more briefly than a scientist. For example, the definition of hypothermia could be two or three lines long, but you could say he did not die, but nothing of life remained, which is how Dante described it in the ninth circle of hell. Dante was much more concise than any doctor could be, so we could just lift it and put it straight in.
So you didn't ever see those as luxuries. You really saw those as integrated into the wider understanding of what practicing medicine was about.
Yeah, I mean, you raised, I think, what was quite a big issue for us against the world in a way, because when all this reduction, we resisted reducing things by cutting out those kind of references, and outside readers sometimes said, look, you know, you can easily cut out this quotation or this reference or a bit where we were perhaps a bit more literary ourselves. And we vigorously went against that and put a lot of work into cutting out some of the more technical things so that we could retain those. When you look at the book, you might say the obvious thing about the book is its form, that it's a very concise, practical book. But actually, I think for us, the attitude came first, and the form was a secondary.
Reading has to be a pleasure, and a book needs to develop its own voice. And we thought this was our way of doing that.
Can I ask you both if you remember the advance copy of the first edition arriving and how that made you feel?
Well, I've seen 17 advance copies now of all the editions of the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine and the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Specialties. But the first edition does stand out, really, because I've had the strong impression that we had scope for development here. Because to go back to our 67-letter rule, it turned out, when I opened the book to see what it was like, that because some letters are wider than others, we had much more space than I thought we had. And so I thought, great, we can put in some new ideas into this book. So I felt here is something that we can build on and develop. And OUP luckily shared that idea.
Actually, the first editions I saw were, in a sense, before what you're even talking about. We had a number of completely blank copies sent to us in various thicknesses of paper, various different plastic covers. With we wanted rounded corners, and the first ones were square and all sorts of things. So OUP started sending us these different editions, which we could then put in our pocket, see whether they tore the stitching of the white coat pocket. We would write in them and see whether the writing then obliterated what was written on the other side. Well, no, it takes the book for granted, but every detail of the cover, the pages, the paper, and the corner and the size were all experimented with prior to there being actually any text printed.
The first edition is quite a different beast inside, isn't it, from the present one? I mean, what would someone who uses the current edition notice among those differences?
First of all, the blank pages are completely blank. Secondly, there's just much less written. There's much less text. There must be, I don't know, half or a third the number of words or letters in the first edition compared with the current edition.
It still bears a good resemblance to its successors. But I think someone coming to the first edition would say, well, I wish I could learn medicine in the 1980s. It was a lot simpler.
When did you get a first sense of how the book was being received?
I remember coming to the first real printed book that I was sent by AUP as a pre-publication copy, and my wife was a junior doctor, and she took it in to her hospital. And she came back about 2 weeks later. She said to me, every night that I'm not on call and somebody else is on call, I come and find the book's been taken from my pocket by the on-call doctor and I have to bleep them the next morning. So she said, I think it's going to be very popular because it keeps getting stolen by the on-call doctor.
I had exactly the opposite impression. I thought it was going to be a complete failure because we heard that the book had been banned in two hospitals because it made learning medicine too easy. And I now realize that banning a book is brilliant marketing. And I would recommend that to anybody seeking to sell a book. Is the first step is to get it banned.
Banned and stolen, it's a perfect combination, isn't it?
Yeah, we have various anecdotes early on. I remember being told that one of the more senior doctors, seeing a student with the book in the pocket, took it out of the pocket and threw it straight out of the window and said, that's medicine for auxiliary nurses. So there was, I think it's difficult now to realize how much antagonism there was about the book. I mean, the initial reviews were almost entirely negative.
What sort of thing did they say? That it was too simplified? It was
the things I think that people didn't like was seeing their own specialty reduced to 30 pages. And I had a bit of this experience later on. I became a psychiatrist, and when Murray and his wife Judith were doing the Handbook of Clinical Specialties, they asked me to look over the section on psychiatry. And I had the experience of seeing what I'd spent 3.5 years of, you know, learning in great detail reduced to these 25 pages or something like that. So I can understand the response. And the other thing, I mean, these were in the days before there were many protocols out there, before the internet, of course, and before evidence-based medicine. And I think there was a general sense that the practice of medicine had to be something that only experienced consultants could tell you how to do. And I think there was a lot of antagonism to the kind of rather didactic approach, I suppose, that the book had.
And was there any resistance, do you think, to the fact that you were still rather junior in the medical hierarchy at the time you wrote it?
There's never been anything in the book to suggest that we are doctors. We have no qualifications in the book. And I think it must be because of our awareness of that we didn't even dare put our most basic qualifications in and want to leave it to the reader to give us all the qualifications that the reader required to have an authoritative book.
I do very much admire Oxford University Press and the then delegate, David Weatherall, who went with the book, even though it was, I mean, it's almost unprecedented for two first-year junior doctors to write a textbook of medicine. And I think OUP took a big risk in allowing us to do that.
And then there must have been a pleasant day when OUP realised that it had a success on its hands and came back to you and said, well, can we have another edition?
Yes. I suppose I remember that occasion was when I was walking with our editor, then Alison Langton, down the corridors of OUP, hearing the printing going on and passing John Manger, who was then the person in charge, and Alison stopping us and introducing us. And he said, do you realize you've got a bestseller on your hands? And we didn't realize that at that point. And we knew then, because we had this extra space, that we had something great to build on. So it was quite chastening to realize that what we thought would be a year's work and then we go on and do something else could become something that could be built on and form part of people's learning lives for a long time.
I was talking to Murray Longmore and Tony Hope about the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. To find out more and to order the book, go to blackwell.co.uk. That's all for this first podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for programmes 2 and 3. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.